Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how Weird Al Yankovic went from working the mailroom to climbing the Billboard charts with songs originally meant as jokes.
Part of my job was to go to the post office every morning and pick up a big bag of mail for the company. And I saw, the new Billboard magazine just came out, and I just opened it up, and I saw I was on the Hot 100 chart. And at that exact moment, I thought, I should give notice. I should probably get serious about this whole Weird Al thing. So I think that very day I said, look, I think I'm probably going to quit.
Coming up, the one, the only Weird Al Yankovic. There are only a tiny handful of artists in history who have had a top 40 single in the U.S. in each of the past four decades. Michael Jackson, Madonna, U2, and Weird Al Yankovic. He's actually one of the most successful living artists in the world, which is not surprising if you parse the lyrics of his songs like Word Crimes or White and Nerdy. They are incredibly intricate and clever. Weird Al figured out pretty early on in life that you could take a hit song, rewrite the lyrics, and make people laugh. And in a lot of cases, he's actually become much more famous than some of the singers he's parodied. Weird Al first hit the airwaves in 1976 on a comedy radio program called The Dr. Demento Show. It was a song about his family's rundown car. It was called Belvedere Cruising. Al would go on to produce dozens of parody songs and also originals and even a film, UHF, which has now become something of a cult classic. Weird Al also wrote another film, a sort of biopic. It's called Weird, The Al Yankovic Story, and it stars Daniel Radcliffe, and it's one of the funniest movies I have ever seen. In this episode of The Great Creators, you'll hear about the moment Weird Al first heard his own voice playing back to him on the radio, about how he had to stretch to get beyond his early fame making parodies of Michael Jackson hits, and about the difficult and painstaking work of writing funny songs. That's all coming up after this quick break.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Alfred Matthew Yankovic grew up just outside of Los Angeles. He was a precocious kid and skipped ahead two grades before he was out of elementary school. He came from a working-class family and says that from his earliest days, his parents, while they weren't quite on his wavelength, always had his back.
My mother is the kind of person that I'd get on the phone with her after like doing something amazing, and she'd like want to know if I'm like, if I'm eating right. You know, she was more concerned about me being healthy than like any kind of amazing thing I was doing in pop culture. But they were both always very supportive. They're not show business people. It was not a show business family in the least. We're about as far away as that as you could possibly get. So it was sort of an alien thing when I started becoming, you know, famous. But they enjoyed it. My dad in particular, who's kind of an extrovert, he would be so proud. He would when he'd be at the supermarket, he would like whip out his wallet and show my senior picture to the woman that was checking him out, like, ah, it's my son Weird Al. You ever hear of Weird Al? So they got a real kick out of it.
And your dad, his name was Nick Yankovic. He was a working class guy, and I understand he worked in a factory, right?
At one point in his life, he was a blue-collar guy, so he had a number of jobs. I mean, he worked in a factory mostly before I was born, actually. And then all during my childhood, he just sort of had, like, part-time jobs, like a street crossing guard, security guard, you know, stuff like that. But, yeah, at one point, he worked in a sheet metal manufacturing plant.
I mean, you were – and, you know, this has been – there's been a biography written about you. You were a nerdy kid. You were
– Yes.
2 years younger than all your classmates. You were a good student. You were like a nerd. You were into math and the accordion, and I mean, that's really who you were as a kid, right?
Absolutely. And that was back in the time when it wasn't cool to be a nerd. Like, yeah. In the last 15 years, all of a sudden people are like trying to establish their nerd cred. Like, oh, yes, I've always been a nerd. Like, oh, I'm a total nerd. And like when I was a kid, that was not something you aspired to. You got to eat lunch all by yourself, you know, on the lonely nerd bench, you know. But yeah, I still am a nerd. I mean, I've never not been a nerd. But I guess in the last couple of decades, that's not become such an offensive thing to be.
Yeah. And being a nerd and also being kind of younger than your peers in high school, I know that your mom was pretty protective of you and was worried about you getting bullied and hurt, but this was a time where that was real. I mean, you grew up in the 70s, you know, getting bullied, that was par for the course, right?
Well, it was for me. I mean, I never really got beat up per se, but I got picked on a lot. It wasn't pleasant. I was definitely younger, and I was the kind of kid that people, you know, put tacks on the seat, put bubble gum in your, you know, locker so you couldn't get in. Small abuses, but after a while, they got pretty annoying. And, you know, that was mostly junior high. Mm-hmm. I think for everybody, like junior high, like grade 7 and 8, that's maybe like the worst time in your life. And it certainly was for me. That was probably when I got bullied the most and really kind of didn't fit in anywhere.
So, all right, so you're a bit of a nerdy kid to begin with, and then you sort of double down on that by learning the accordion. And as I understand it, you picked it up after your parents were approached by a door-to-door salesman.
Yeah, so a door-to-door accordion salesman actually did come to our house. I mean, selling accordion lessons, actually. The guy that came to our door said, well, we could have your son take accordion lessons or guitar lessons. And my parents, being the visionaries that they were, said, oh, young Alfred would love to play the accordion, I'm sure. Who wouldn't want to learn the accordion? You're a one-man band. You're the life of any party. He'll be so popular in high school playing the accordion.
Tell me about humor at home. I mean, were your parents funny? I mean, were they – from everything I've read, they were protective of you but also loved you and very supportive. But were they funny? Was there joking around the house? I mean – I read that your mom didn't let you listen to Dr. Demento, that radio show that you discovered when you were a kid. So I don't know. What was their approach joking?
Well, she wasn't offended by the humor. She just thought that some of the songs got a little risque and a little blue. I mean, and again, not like harsh profanities, but there's a lot of double entendres and things that were like, you know, slyly sexual. And she just was offended by that and thought that her young teenage son shouldn't be listening to that kind of filth. So I had to always listen in private, like late at night when my folks were asleep.
So, all right. And what about like humor at home? I mean, were your parents funny? Did they like watching comedies? I mean, yes, they were, as you say, sort of maybe a little bit culturally conservative in that they didn't want to expose you to sexualized humor, which is normal for a lot of parents. But, you know, did they encourage your kind of weird humor?
Well, I don't think they were put off by it. I mean, they didn't. They certainly didn't encourage me to go into showbiz. Because, in fact, I remember when I was first starting to like go in that direction, my mother told me in no uncertain terms that I should stay out of Hollywood because there are evil people there.
She's not wrong.
And she's not wrong. No. But she was very concerned. And as far as being funny, I mean, they weren't. Not funny. I mean, they weren't like serious. Particularly my dad, like I said, my mother was more introverted and my dad was more extroverted. And I think I've got both parts of those personality within me. I mean, I'm a little bipolar personality wise, yeah. I think. But my dad, I guess my dad was the funnier one. He was certainly the one that would be joking around more and hanging out with friends and making them laugh. So I don't know that I necessarily got my sense of humor from him, but he enjoyed what I did and more or less got the joke. I mean, neither one of my parents was really up on pop culture, so they weren't always familiar with like the songs I was making fun of or anything like that, or got a lot of the references, but they understood it was funny and they certainly didn't disapprove of what I was doing.
Dr. Demento, a lot of people, of course, know who he is, and his name was Barry Hansen, and he had this show. I remember listening on the radio in Southern California, Mighty 690, I think, played his show, syndicated his show when I was a kid, and we listened in the early 80s. And you were obviously a huge fan of his show. This was a time where you could, like, you know, you could really, you know, participate in these shows. You actually sent in a cassette. I think you'd done it a couple times. You tried to be on the show before, like maybe you even met him at one point. But in 1976, you did successfully get a song onto a show, which anybody watching this or listening to this can find. I don't know if you want me to say that, Al, but it's available on YouTube. Belvedere Cruising is available to hear.
This is nothing that I would officially release because I'm not like proud of it, but I guess the people that want to hear it for historical purposes, it's out on the internet somewhere. I'm sure you could find it.
Yeah. And when that song was aired, it's about your family's car, which I guess was a bit of a jalopy. How thrilling was that? I mean, you were like 16 and he played your song on the show.
Yeah, I was. I remember I was listening to the Dr. Demento show, and he didn't normally play any unsolicited material. It was all stuff from his archives, you know, because he's a big collector of music. And it wasn't normal for him to play like just a tape that some kid had sent in the mail. And I remember I was listening to his show, and I heard the beginning of my song come on. And my initial thought was, oh, did I accidentally turn on my tape recorder? Like, why is that song playing? And then I realized, no, this is actually playing on the radio. And then I completely freaked out. It's sort of like in every biopic you've ever seen where somebody hears their song on the radio for the first time. They just go nuts. And I think I just started running around the house screaming, Mom, Dad, I'm on the radio, you know. And I just couldn't believe it. It was like, I thought, oh, my life is never going to get any better than this. This is the high point of my life.
But at this point, you still had ambitions to become an architect, which is why you went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, a great school. But two of my nephews went there. But that was your vision. That was your dream.
Well, I mean, yeah, to be that was my plan, at least. I mean, if you'd have told me, do you want to be an architect or do you want to be a recording artist? If that was the choice, I would have said, the second one sounds more fun to me. But I just thought that wasn't an option. I just thought, like, I was not, like, going to have any career resembling at all what I am currently doing. I mean, that just seemed, like, beyond my grasp. That seemed like that was just not even an option. So architecture sounded like something that an adult would do, that you could, like, go to college and learn how to do and then actually have a career doing that. I didn't think, oh, I'll just take my accordion and I'll just be, you know, I'll put out 14 albums and tour the country. You know, nobody had ever done anything like that before.
I wonder, because I've read a lot about your time in college at San Luis Obispo and, you know, I mean, your name, Weird Al, it was not a nice thing that people said to you. They called it, there's Weird Al. You were kind of, from what I've read, you were sort of maybe ostracized. I don't know if that's the right word, but it seems to me that you didn't, people weren't nice to you when you were a young man in college and you were this kind of nerdy guy. And obviously you've made that work for you in a massive way. You kind of completely turned that on its head. But I wonder if you remember when you were a student, you know, in your dorm room playing the accordion in your room and walking out and seeing all the other guys like hang out and shoot the breeze. Like, Was that painful? Do you remember feeling sad about or isolated or lonely?
Well, not everybody was mean to me. I mean, I don't want to paint the picture that like everybody hated the weird nerd, you know, because I had friends and people were generally social. But, you know, also I also didn't fit in, you know, I would get funny looks every now and then. And there are certainly some people in my dorm room that maybe would avoid me because they thought, oh, that's this kid's too weird. I was a little different. You know, and I was okay with that. And that's where the nickname came from. And it was, you know, it was not meant as a friendly nickname so much. It was just sort of like, oh, there goes Weird Al. But when I started doing radio shows on the college campus radio station and you needed some kind of wacky air name, I thought, well, Weird Al? Yep, works for me. You know, it kind of felt like that's my version of Dr. Demento. I'll play weird music on the radio, you know. And eventually people just, you know, started calling me Weird Al and in a non-derogatory way. And I embraced whatever weird part of my personality that I was, you know, displaying at the time. And, you know, I found that taking on the name Weird Al, you know, it was sort of a whim when I did it. But I found that people have found that empowering. Like over the course of my career, a lot of people that would consider themselves outcasts or freaks or different or just not accepted by normal society, people would look at me and go, oh, there's a guy that's like, you know, accepting of his own weirdness and he's proud of it and he doesn't care what people think. And they found that uplifting for them, which, you know, that's nice. I'm glad I could be that kind of a role model, as it were.
But did you have to become comfortable with that, or was it just easy to be comfortable with that?
I mean, I never felt uncomfortable with that. I mean, it's just an extension of my personality. I don't think I've ever tried to, you know, change my personality to fit in. I've always just kind of been the person that I am. And sometimes people didn't accept that, and sometimes they did. It's all about finding your people. I mean, you can always find your people, which is something I tell my daughter all the time. It's like, you know, not everybody is going to, you know, mesh with your personality, but you'll find the people that do, and those will be your friends.
Apparently there's a plaque inside of a bathroom at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo commemorating the place where you recorded My Bologna, your parody of My Sharona, in the bathroom. And you used the bathroom because the acoustics, I guess, were, you know, had some reverb in the bathroom, right?
That's correct. I did, in fact, record my first nationally released single in a bathroom, and it was the bathroom across the hall from my college campus radio station. And the reason we did that was because I couldn't afford to go into a real recording studio. And the bathroom, as everybody knows, has a great reverb sound. That's what people sing in the bathroom. You sound great.
Yeah.
And it was just this beautifully tiled bathroom, had a nice, natural reverb sound to
was
it.
Was it a beautiful bathroom? You said beautiful, beautifully
tiled. In my heart, it was beautiful.
Okay.
It wasn't like an Art Deco bathroom, but you know, in my memory, it was beautiful. So we just ran lines from the production room in the radio station across the hall into the bathroom, and set up a chair and a microphone, and that's where I recorded My Bologna.
And you sent it, same deal. And at this point, had you met? I know that you briefly had met Dr. Demento when he came to speak at your school, maybe in middle school. But at this point, had you formally met him? Did you know each other?
He probably was aware of me and that I had sent him a few tapes in the mail already. In fact, I'm pretty sure he did, because as soon as I sent him My Bologna and it started getting airplay on his show, he started sending me postcards letting me know how it did. In fact, I still have the first postcard I ever got from him in 1976, where he said, "Hi, Al, are you any relation to Frankie Yankovic, the Polka King?"
Wow.
Because there's a very famous accordion player named Frankie Yankovic. No relation. But that was, of course, the first thing he thought of, because he's got a lot of Frankie Yankovic records. And I had to explain, no relation, but we're, you know, that's maybe the reason my parents decided I should take accordion lessons, because, you know, they thought, you know, Yankovic, accordion, those go together. Why not?
Yeah. So up until this point, you were really perceived probably as a super fan, right? Like just a super, and you were a super fan of the show.
Sure.
Who was contributing. But then you send this tape in and he plays it and it's a hit. Like it's a massive hit. In fact, the Knack, who recorded My Sharona, they loved it. And you were just as, you were a student. I mean, you were a student at Cal Poly. Did other kids on campus, do you remember their reaction? Because they probably were aware that all of a sudden, hey, there's a guy, Al, who has a song, this parody song on Dr. Demento's show.
I wasn't like a celebrity on campus or anything like that. I was more known for just doing my weekly Saturday night radio show. It was, when I got back to L.A. or someplace that, you know, actually heard the Dr. D'Amato show, that people would take notice. Like the Knack heard My Bologna, and Doug Feiger, the lead singer, was somewhat responsible for me getting signed to Capitol Records. And when I say signed, I mean they put out My Bologna, and that was it. That was the extent of their relationship. But I went to a Knack concert at Cal Poly. They actually played my school, and this is after My Bologna had come out, or actually, you know, it was on the Dr. D'Amato show. It wasn't released officially.
Yeah.
And I somehow snuck backstage just to say hi to the band, and I met, you know, Doug Feiger, and he said, "Oh, you're the My Bologna guy." And he turns to the guy immediately to his right and says, "This is the guy that did My Bologna. You should put him out on Capitol Records." And the guy he was turning to was the vice president of Capitol Records.
Wow.
Who just happened to be at that show. So they put out my record, I think as a goof more than anything else. But even though I don't think they took it seriously, Capitol Records certainly didn't take it seriously. It made me think like, wow, well, this is more fun than being an architect. Maybe I should try to do this.
We're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, Weird Al Yankovic gets a co-writing credit with the King of Pop. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. So Weird Al Yankovic moved to Los Angeles right after graduation and got a job working for Westwood One, the national radio network that syndicated Dr. Demento's show. And his first job there was a classic first job.
Yeah, I started in the mailroom, which was like making deliveries and just taking care of the mail. And then within a year or two, I graduated to an actual desk job, which wasn't as fun, frankly. It was just mostly like calling up radio stations on the phone and making sure that they played their bubblicious spots at the right time, you know. And it was just that was more of a grind. But, you know, I was just happy to have a job.
I mean, you were working in the mailroom, and at the same time, you got like a slot on the Tom Snyder show, playing Another One Rides the Bus. Like you were on a late night talk show, and also like your day job was working in the mailroom.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, before I had a record deal, so it was just, you know, airplay on the Dr. D'Amato show doesn't pay the bills. So yeah. I had to, like, you know, pay for my macaroni and cheese and work in the mailroom. And also, on occasion, I would do amazing things like fly to New York and be on the Tom Snyder show.
What was it that gave you the impetus to pursue music full time as a career? I mean, obviously, you were doing it after college, but it seemed unclear that was going to be a career that you could actually make a living off of. What happened to give you the confidence to pursue it?
Well, I got my record deal in 1982, And again, it was not the kind of thing where it was like, oh, here's a big pile of money. Thank you for signing with us. It was just sort of like, okay, now we've got you under contract. And my first album came out in 1983. And all this time, I was still working at Westwood One. And I didn't give my notice until my first single was on the Billboard charts. I remember, you know, part of my job was to go to the post. This would have been, I think this was Ricky.
Yeah,
based
on Ricky.
Tony Basil's Mickey. And part of my job was to go to the post office every morning and pick up a big bag of mail for the company. And I saw, oh, the new Billboard magazine just came out, and I just opened it up and I saw I was on the Hot 100 chart. And at that exact moment, I thought, I should give notice. I should probably get serious about this whole Weird Al thing. So I think that very day I said, look, I think I'm probably going to quit.
All right. So Ricky, which is a parody of Mickey. Oh, Mickey, you're so fine. But it's you as Ricky Ricardo with Lucy. And it's so funny. And you did a video of this as well. And it was like this kind of perfect storm because it was right as sort of videos started to become more popular, right? As MTV was launching. And, you know, you were making these parody songs. I Love Rocky Road, obviously the parody of I Love Rock and Roll that was a remake that Joan Jett did. So how do you remember being perceived at the time? I mean, when people met you, they're like, oh, this is Weird Al, you know, the guy that does the parody songs. This is that guy.
Yeah. And Ricky was like, I wouldn't say it was like a big hit. I mean, it got some airplay on MTV, but it wasn't like some overwhelming hit. It was, I believe, I could be wrong, but I'm led to believe that was the first comedy music video ever played on MTV. MTV wow. started like around the end of 1981, I believe. And most people didn't even get it, but that's when it started. And Ricky came out in early 1983. And again, this is at a point in time when a lot of people didn't even get MTV. And they were just starting to figure out what it was. But the people that watched MTV watched it pretty obsessively, or they left it on all the time. I know when I first got MTV, it was just sort of like video wallpaper in my house. I just left it on, and it was like having the radio station on, but it was like MTV. And like every now and then you'd like, you know, so, oh, there's David Bowie. Look at that. So it wasn't until Eat It that people really took notice. And then I became like the Eat It guy. Then I was kind of cemented in people's minds as the guy that did song parodies.
How did you, I mean, you're famously, you get permission from every artist whose songs you parody, which you're not required to do by law, but you do that out of respect for them. I mean, even in 1984, when Eat It came out, you were getting better known, and you had a song, and Ricky and I Love Rocky Road were certainly getting airplay, but how did you convince Michael Jackson to let you parody Beat It?
Well, I didn't have a personal conversation. I didn't call him, hey, Michael, you know, it was, you know, my people and his people talking. But it eventually got to him, which amazed me because, I mean, just to even reach Michael Jackson at that point, you have to understand, like in 1983, 84, Michael Jackson was like the most famous person in the universe. It was just unbelievably famous. But somehow my request came across his desk and he thought, oh, sounds like a funny idea. So yeah, he signed off on it. In fact, there's a contract somewhere with my signature next to Michael Jackson's signature saying that we are the co-writers of Eat It, which is really crazy, but it's true, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there you put out a documentary of your life, I should say in air quotes, called The Complete Al, and that scene is depicted. But you actually, in that documentary, you are depicted as meeting Michael Jackson. He feeds a tiger some meat from his hand and blesses this this request, and then you go on and make Eat It. Eat It was, I think it hit number 12 on the Billboard 100 charts. It was a massive song.
In the U.S. it did, yeah. It did actually, you know, this is kind of a funny factoid. Eat It hit number 1 in Australia. And Michael Jackson's Beat It only made it to number 3.
It's totally nuts. I mean, all of a sudden, that really propelled you to fame. You were very famous. I remember as a kid seeing that video, and it was amazing. What do you remember about that time in your life? Because, yes, you were making parody songs, but they were huge. They were massive. You were actually as famous as some of the people you started to parody.
Well, this was sort of the golden age of MTV. I mean, this is when, this would have been like 1984, and this was when everybody was obsessed with MTV.
Yeah.
And if you're in heavy rotation on MTV, that was a big deal. That was a star-making thing, because they would play your video, you know, 8 times a day. And people became intimately familiar with every video in rotation on MTV. And the fact that I was getting as much airplay as Michael Jackson at the time was an incredibly huge deal. So that made me, you know, they talk about overnight fame. It's sort of happened with me, because I mean, I remember the day after Eat It went into heavy rotation, people recognized me on the streets immediately. Yeah. Which was strange for me, because I was like, you know, a fairly anonymous guy my whole life, and then the next day I you know, I'm walking on the street and people are staring at me and going like, that's the guy on MTV. And it's pretty much been that way ever since, but it was that transition was pretty immediate.
You were the guy because you had that, the long hair, you know, the curly hair and the mustache and the glasses. You were instantly recognizable.
Yeah, that was a look. I mean, I don't look quite that way anymore, but that was such an iconic look that whenever kids dress up like me for Halloween, and quite a number of them do, I found, it's always the classic Al look. You know, there's something about that particular look that really was cemented in people's minds. And, you know, I got my LASIK surgery in 1998, I think, and my hair looks different now, but people still haven't quite gotten over my 80s look. That seems like it's like that's Weird Al to them.
Yeah,
somehow.
All right, so here's the thing. I mean, there was a time in your career where you, from what I gather, you were really successful, and you were remaking Michael Jackson songs, but that maybe you sort of felt like, you know, once you parodied Bad as Fat, you kind of peaked out, like that was it. You know, you were. Is that true? Like, did you worry about that? That maybe you were going to just be perceived as this guy who does Michael Jackson parodies about food, and that was it.
Well, you know, I didn't mind being known as the parody guy, but I mean, having done 2 Michael Jackson parodies, I kind of didn't want to be like, you know, the guy that does Michael Jackson parodies necessarily. Like at one point I was thinking about doing a 3rd Michael Jackson parody, and I thought, do I really want to go down this road? Because it seemed like every time I did Michael Jackson, it was immensely popular. And there's always that temptation to keep grabbing that brass ring, you know, while it was there. But at the same time, it was like you didn't want to like get locked into like a very narrow perception of yourself. So there was that, and the food thing as well. I mean, I did a lot of songs that were food related, to the point where my record label, sort of against my wishes, put out a whole compilation called The Food Album, where it's all my songs about food. And at that point, I thought, I never said like I'm never going to do another song about food, but I made a very conscious decision, like maybe try not to write so many songs about food.
All right, I think around 1989, you land a deal to make a feature film. You co-wrote it. You starred in it. The movie was called UHF. It was about this guy, played by you, who's kind of stumbles into running a local TV station, and he, while running it, he makes, I guess, some eclectic programming choices. I love this movie. I just watched it with my kids actually recently. It's somewhat of a cult classic today, but back then, when it came out, it was not so well received. I think Roger Ebert gave it like 1 star. He clearly didn't seem to get the humor. And the film did not do that well when it was released. How did you react to that? Did you feel that, I don't know, like that you failed somehow?
Yeah, I mean, it was devastating for me at the time, particularly because it was getting such buzz. I mean, the people that had seen it loved it. Orion Pictures, who was the company that put it out, said it tested as well as the original RoboCop. They thought, oh, this is going to be a big summer blockbuster movie. They were talking about like having a long career with me. They said, you're going to be our next Woody Allen, at a time when that was not a bad thing. they made it like this is going to be the beginning of your film career. And after the first weekend, when it flopped at the box office, I was basically a ghost. Like, they didn't even want to establish eye contact with me. It was very awkward and embarrassing. And I just kind of had the rug pulled out from under me. So, it was sort of depressing for me for a while. And it took me a while to kind of get over that, because it had been built up to such an extent that I just thought, okay, this is what I'm going to be. I'm just going to be making movies from now on, which obviously was not the case. Took me 33 years to get back on the horse.
But it's interesting, because something around that time, I guess, happened, which is you sort of hit this point where your career slowed down. And I guess you reapproached Michael Jackson to do a parody version of Black or White, his song Black or White, and you wanted to do a parody version of it. What was the proposal called?
I think it was Snack All Night, I think it was.
Snack All Night, yeah. Snack All Night. And he said no. That was the first time he said, no, I don't want you to do that.
Yeah, and which was actually the biggest favorite, because I was sort of like giving into my demons, like, you need another hit. You got to come back. You need a hit. And I knew in my soul that that was not the right decision, because I didn't want to be like the guy always doing Michael Jackson songs. And because he said no, it forced me to look somewhere else. And shortly after that, Nirvana came along, and I did Smells Like Nirvana. And that completely reinvigorated my career and introduced me to a whole new generation of fans. So I'm very happy he said no. I'd like to think in my heart of hearts that he maybe had my best interests in mind. He was kind of saving me for myself.
Yeah, I mean, that song, Smells Like Nirvana, which, and you and Kurt Cobain apparently loved it. I mean, he's quoted as calling you America's modern pop rock genius.
That was in his journal, yeah. Couldn't believe it.
We're going to take another quick break, but when we come back, why it can take Weird Al a month or even more of intensive work to craft just one song. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. So with Smells Like Nirvana, Weird Al Yankovic had his second Billboard Top 40 hit and a revitalized career. And at this point, his practice of writing parody songs had transitioned from just scribbling down lyrics to a very exacting process.
When I first started out, I didn't think, oh, these songs are going to live on forever, and I'm going to be playing this song on stage 40 years from now. That was not part of my mindset. So, like, Another One Rides the Bus, I literally wrote that in, like, 20 minutes. I dashed that off. I thought, oh, this will be funny, and we'll just play it on the Dr. Mano show at probably once, and nobody will ever hear it again. And then after that took off and a few other songs took off, I thought, I should probably spend more time on these. So now, it could be, if I'm forced to, I could write a song in a couple of days, but normally, I think I would budget myself at least a week to write a song. And for some of the more complicated songs, I could spend a month or more just on one song, because I'm sort of obsessive compulsive in that way. I'm laser focused when I'm writing something, and I'll spend days trying to figure out, should this be a comma or a semicolon? You know, it's like, every single detail's got to be just right for it to work for me.
Let's take an example, if you don't mind. Word Crimes. I think Word Crimes is one of your most amazing songs. It's a parody, of course, of Blurred Lines. And amazing, because I can't imagine how you put that song together. I mean, it's so complex. How many versions of lines do you go through for a song like that, for example?
Quite a few. Like for every line in the song, I've got 12 other variations, you know, and extra verses. And I'll have like dozens and dozens of pages of notes for any given song, just because I like to explore every possibility and collect every gag related to a particular theme that I can, and then kind of condense it into a song format and use the best ideas and try to use lyrics that flow the best. It's a real process. On any given song, I could show you a chart where every single line of the lyric, there's one that's selected and there's 10 others that I didn't select because I thought the one I selected just kind of flows a little better, or it's funnier, or it gets the idea across more efficiently. It's something that I didn't do in my early days, obviously. And now as I spend more time and energy to craft my songs, you know, I go through the trouble of doing it that way.
Do you go through phases where you're writing things that are so funny, but you're actually not laughing out loud because it's such an intense process, or do you laugh as you write?
Well, I certainly wouldn't consider myself tortured in any sense, but writing is hard. My wife can tell you, like, when I'm in the process of writing something and I'll walk around the house with this 1,000-mile stare on my face. I'm just like a zombie. Like I'm in another world. I'm very in my head, as she would say. So it's difficult for me, and it's not the fun part of what I do. Writing for me is not fun, but I feel a tremendous sense of accomplishment having written something. So it's all about, you know, getting to the point where you've written something. And I'll have a few moments here and there, little epiphanies, or sometimes when I'll come up with a rhyme that I think is really funny, that'll be a little moment of joy, like, oh, that's really good. Like, I'm so proud of myself. But a lot of the process is just me just, you know, being obsessive. And again, it's still a nice gig to have. I don't want to downplay that. I'm so glad that I don't have to work in the mailroom. But the joy for me is performing, and recording is fun too. And the writing, I don't mind certainly, but that's the actual work.
I wonder, when you are going through that process, do you bounce things off other people? Like, do you say, oh, I've got to call this person, or I've got to test this line out with that person, or not?
I don't do that a lot, but it is kind of hard to write comedy in a vacuum. And a lot of times I'll just like run it by whoever's next to me. Like in the last couple of decades, that's been my wife, and say, what do you think of this, honey? And she'll either like it or not like it. And if she doesn't like it, I'll say, well, where are your Grammys? You know, what do you know? I take ideas or suggestions or commentary from anybody, because, you know, my opinion is not always the right one. And I like to get feedback, but more often than not, I'm just kind of trusting my own gut instincts and hoping that based on what I've done so far in my life and career, that I kind of have a sense of what's funny and what's going to work.
I mean, obviously you're looking and listening to a lot of music and absorbing a lot of popular culture, because there's so many references in your work that it's just mind-boggling to me that how closely you follow these things. Where do you seek out ideas and sort of creative inspiration?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a fan of pop culture anyway, so to be a student of pop culture is not a stretch, because I just, you know, I go to movies, I listen to the radio, or now more often internet and streaming services. And I used to be obsessively watching the Billboard charts. I'm not doing that quite so much these days, but for a big part of my life, that was what I would do. I would, like, you know, see like who's on the top 10 this week, and are any of those, you know, iconic enough to do a song parody of, and of those which would lend themselves well to parody, because not every song that's popular necessarily can translate to a parody, because it's got to have a certain number of characteristics that make it worthwhile, a certain musical or lyrical hook. Sometimes even if it has all those things, I just can't think of a funny enough idea. So it's always a pleasure for me when I'm able to have that perfect storm and have it work out, and then have the artist have a good sense of humor about it. That's another part of the equation. So it's tough to make all those things happen at once.
What do you think is a misconception about you or what you do that maybe people don't actually really know?
Well, since you brought that up, I mean, certainly this isn't a misconception among my fans, but for casual fans or for people that aren't really familiar with me, they think all I do is parodies.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's all he does is just change the words to other people's songs, which, you know, certainly that's what I'm famous for. And I've done that my whole life. And half of my albums consist of straight song parodies. But the other half is original. And, you know, hopefully those songs are funny as well. In fact, some fans will contend that those songs are actually funnier than the parodies, as a matter of opinion. In fact, the tour that we're doing right now, the Unfortunate Return of the Ridiculously Self-Indulgent Ill-Advised Vanity Tour, is comprised exclusively of those original songs. Again, the fans certainly know that, but if you like, oh, the Eat It guy, you know, wasn't he popular in the 80s? Like, yeah, those people may not even be aware that I do original material.
And when it comes to some of those misperceptions about what you do, right, when you're sort of described as like a comedic performer, I mean, that's not inaccurate, right? I mean, I think that's a good description.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't even have any aspirations to do anything dramatic per se. I certainly don't have any interest in writing like serious song lyrics. In fact, I think it was last year. I'm friends with the band Portugal the Man, mm-hmm. and I've done some remixes
That's
for
right.
them.
Yes, yes, I saw that. Yeah.
And played on their song. But they at one point, John Gourley, the lead singer, wanted to like write a song with me. And he wanted me to try writing the bridge to the song. And it was like this earnest song. And like it was like so against my DNA to write like earnest lyrics. Like, and I always wanted to like give it a twist
yeah.
or like make it tongue in cheek or ironic. And it was like, it went against my very nature. And I think I finally gave up and said, I can't do this, man. I can't like write a serious song.
Where does your energy come from, Al? I mean, you're on a tour now, and we're talking, I think it's 133 cities. You're going, I feel like you're going to every city in the United States at least once. I mean, Melbourne, Florida, you know, Poughkeepsie, New York, like everywhere, up all over Santa Rosa, California, places where, you know, big names don't often go. This is a massive commitment of time and energy, and you're doing night after night after night after night after night, and you are performing and singing, and then you're meeting people after, then you get on a bus and you go to the next place, or you sleep in a hotel for a night. And I can't imagine sleeping on a bus is a good night's rest. Where do you find that energy?
It's just a mindset, man. You have like a family on the road. I've been with the same band for like 40 years.
Yeah.
I've been with a crew for a very long time. We're all married. Some of us have families, and that's the difficult part. But once you get on the road, you just kind of get into the groove, you know, I save up my energy for when I'm, you know, on stage. And then once I get off stage, I've got enough adrenaline going that I can, like, you know, hang out with fans and still be personable. But yeah, I mean, the rest of the day, I kind of live like a monk. I try not to talk if possible.
Sorry.
I need to save my voice if I'm doing... No. I'm making an exception for you, my friend. But yeah, so normally I just save up my voice because I do like 5 shows a week generally. And yeah, it takes a lot out of me. And if I lose my voice, there's no easy way to come back from that. But yeah, I still get a blast every night being on stage. It's an adrenaline rush. The fans still really enjoy it. And I just have a great time. So it's nice that I found a way to make a living that doesn't drive me crazy.
Al, I'm curious because you are, and you referenced this earlier, you've got the introverted side and then the kind of goofy but performer side. But you are an introvert. I mean, everything I've read about you in articles about you make that clear. And I get it. I mean, you know, because you are surrounded by fans, and I've been to your show. I've been to one of your shows where there are hundreds and hundreds of people waiting to meet you afterwards, dressed up as Weird Al. You spend so much time. In fact, I was with my family waiting to meet you backstage, and I think we waited about 2 hours after the show because you spent so much time with your fans. And it was amazing. I kept peeking back there, and just people really are so connected to you. And that requires a lot of energy for an introvert. So how do you sort of harness that energy and not be an introvert for that time?
You just make the effort. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm not feeling, you know, great or like being social, or sometimes when I'm not even in a big in a good mood, but I know what it means to these people. I remember being a kid and going up to a celebrity and asking for an autograph, and that interaction maybe lasted 5-10 seconds, but that's the opinion I have of that person for the rest of my life. And I always have that in mind when I'm meeting people, like, you know, they're only hanging out with you for a few seconds, but that is going to inform their opinion of you forever. So I always make a special effort, even if I'm not feeling great or feeling happy or whatever. I always try to be engaging and personable and charming and try to be the best version of myself so that, you know, people have a good experience.
So much of what, certainly in the last few years, it's been, I think it's fair to say, it's been a challenging few years in human history. The pandemic and political upheaval and violence and so on. And so many people who've written about you have said, you know, the thing is that just this is joyful. Like there's this, I need this joy in my life. And I know a lot of people have said that to you probably, especially in the last few years where it's been such a, especially in this country, so difficult. Do you feel like that is your purpose? Like if you were put on the planet by, you know, Klingons or God or whatever, you know, like your purpose is to do that, is to bring joy to people?
I mean, feels weird for me to admit it, but I kind of think so. I mean, it's escapist entertainment. You know, part of me feels like I should, you know, make reference to some of the hardships we've had to endure over the last few years. But I think more than that, people are looking to get away from that, to not think about that, and to just, you know, have some fun. And I understand what I mean to some people, that some people tell me how I've gotten them through a really rough period in their life. So I'm very cognizant of that, and I appreciate that. I always think about Tex Avery, the famous Golden Age of animation animator, who did Droopy Dog and, like, you know, famous animator. And on his deathbed, he told his friends that he thought he'd wasted his life because he just made these goofy, stupid cartoons. And that made me feel terrible because, I mean, he enriched so many people's lives to this day, he's still, like, you know, making people happy and making people laugh. And that's no small thing. And hopefully I'll never feel that way. I mean, I don't feel like I've wasted my life doing stupid things. I mean, I think I've brought joy to a lot of people, and I think that's worthwhile.
You know, we're also living at a time where sensitivities, specifically around humor, are heightened, right? And there are some comedians who, you know, who won't perform on college campuses, for example, because of certain sensitivities. And I wonder how you approach that. I mean, even a song like White and Nerdy, which is just brilliant and incredible, you know, it could be perceived by some as appropriative. Or, you know, Lizzo took out the word spastic from one of her recent songs because there was pushback from some listeners saying that it's an ableist word or that's a word that's appeared in some of your music. I'm not criticizing you at all. I mean, this is not meant to be a critique. I just wonder how you think about writing comedy, you know, in an era when sensitivities are so much more heightened.
I'm certainly not pushing back against that. I try to be very sensitive. I mean, I don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah,
I had the same issue that Lizzo had, and I was horrified because that word doesn't mean the same thing in the U.S. that it means in the U.K. and Australia.
Right.
It's a horrible slur over there. And if I'd have known that, obviously, I would not have done that. And when we, you know, perform outside of the U.S., we omit that part of the song. To this day, I feel badly because, you know, I love that song, and that's sort of like the one stain on that song is, like, I can't play that outside of the country because that word is extremely offensive, you know, outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
And other than that, I mean, there are things that I did early in my career. You know, I actually say this in part of my live show now that, you know, language is fluid and things change, and some things that weren't offensive like in the 80s or 90s are very offensive today. And I'm aware of that, and I'm trying my best to deal with that and to be funny, but still without offending people. I think that's very easy to do if you're just willing to make the effort.
And Michael Jackson songs or parodies you don't perform right anymore.
Well, you know, I said that I didn't want to perform that on the 2019 tour. I don't think I ever made a blanket statement that I would never do them again. And this got really blown out of proportion, too, because an interviewer asked me if I was not going to do Michael Jackson songs on the tour. And I said, well, not on this particular tour, because like the Leaving Neverland documentaries had just come out. Yeah. It was a very hot button topic, and people were, you know, very sensitive to it. And I didn't want to, you know, make people nervous or offended or put them in a situation where they're feeling uneasy. And I thought, for that particular tour, let's not do the Michael Jackson songs. And, you know, the Michael Jackson fans took that out of context and were extremely mad at me for a while. And like, he made you everything you are today. How dare you? Yeah. And like, you know, I'm just trying to like be sensitive to people and not, you know, make them uncomfortable. Cause like you can choose to listen to it at home or not. But when you're at a concert audience, you know, and I play a song that makes you uncomfortable, you just have to sit there and be uncomfortable. So I'm just trying my best to do the right thing. And, you know, they may or may not come back in the future. But at that particular point in time, I just felt that it was not the best choice.
I think you're one of four artists in modern history that has had a top 40 single in every decade, four decades in a row. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm the only one of three to have my own singles in four decades. It's me, Madonna, and Michael Jackson.
It's amazing.
And I think both U2 and Kenny G sort of got in on a technicality because they were featured on somebody's song.
They ruin everything.
You scoff, yes.
They ruin it all.
They ruined it for everybody.
But it is remarkable. I mean, when you started your career as a comedy singer, could you have imagined that? Like, Michael Jackson, Madonna, Weird Al.
It still kind of blows my mind. You know, when I first started, when I tried to get a record deal, I won't mention any names or the company, but one executive said, like, you know, this is funny, but you're basically going to be a one-hit wonder. And that was something that always kind of stuck with me because that was sort of like the domain of novelty music. Like novelty musicians, certainly in the 60s, were famous for like having one hit and then never being heard from again. That was sort of like the template. So I've sort of like bucked the mold. I think I'm probably the longest running quote-unquote novelty musician in history because I've outlasted a lot of people who I parodied, you know, early on in my career. So the fact that I've had this long career, I'm sure would have surprised even me back then.
And you think it's because you were just very, very committed to keep going and to grinding away?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I have a joy in what I do. I love doing what I do. You know, some people that start out doing comedy music were like, okay, now I've got your attention. Here's my real music, my serious music. And that's not me. I have no desire to do that. I love doing exactly what I'm doing. I mean, I've sort of gotten beyond this. For a lot of my career, the early part of my career, it was always like, you know, I got to like stay in the public consciousness. I got to put out this album. I've got to always keep grabbing that brass ring, you know, so people don't forget about me. And now that I've done it long enough, I kind of feel like, you know, I think people know who I am and they either like me or they don't. But I mean, I don't think at this point that people are going to necessarily forget about me.
You are a very youthful early 60s gentleman. I should say, people are shocked when they find out you're in your early 60s. I hope I'm not giving anything away, although it's public information, because you don't look your age. But I wonder, I mean, are you going to keep going till you die, till you just croak and that's it?
I think that's the plan. I mean, you know, why stop doing what you love doing? I have no reason to retire. I mean, people have called me retired because I kind of publicly said I'm not going to do any more conventional albums. I decided that Mandatory Fun was as probably, I mean, again, I hate to draw a hard line in the sand, but I think that's probably going to be my last album. And it's a great way to go out on top because it was a number one album.
Amazing. A number one record. It was we should have mentioned that.
I know.
Number one.
It feels weird to walk away after that, but I just kind of feel like, you know, I'll still do music. You know, I did a new song for the movie. There may, in fact, be a soundtrack album for the movie. Well, yeah, that's still being talked about. So, I mean, I'll still be involved making music and doing music projects, but I also want to just try other things. I mean, maybe this movie will lead to other movies. Who knows? You know, and there's other things I'd like to do. And even if I feel like just not doing anything, that's fine too.
Yeah.
but I still love doing what I do, and there's no reason to actually retire from that.
That's Weird Al Yankovic. And that movie he just referenced there is his satirical biopic loosely based on his life and career. It's called Weird, the Al Yankovic Story. By the way, if you ever go to a Weird Al concert, you will see hundreds of fans dressed up like Weird Al from the 80s. Curly wig, oversized glasses, and Hawaiian shirts. And the reason Al wore Hawaiian shirts for so many years, well, that's unclear. But for a while, Al's tour contract stipulated that the promoter had to provide at least one garish Hawaiian shirt per concert. Weird Al collected so many of those shirts that when he got married, his exasperated wife sent several hundred of them to Goodwill. But don't worry, Al still has a walk-in closet full of them. You can find links to some of the music videos Weird Al talked about during our conversation. They're in the show notes for this episode at thegreatcreators.com/Yankovic. And the show notes for every episode live at thegreatcreators.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for listening to our episode this week. We have one ask. Please help us spread the word and tell people to listen to The Great Creators. And please follow us on social media. Just search for The Great Creators. This episode was produced by Bruce Wallace and edited by Jessica Diehl with help from Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Kevin Leahy, Elaine Coates, Jenna Gedman, Nat Hoops, Michael May, Andrea Bruce, Michelle Triant, and Daniel Shukin. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.